Welcome. Jeff Liebman joins us today to talk about social impact bonds, also known as pay for success. He's a professor at the Harvard Kennedy School and the director of the Taubman Center for State and Local Government. He also directs the Social Impact Bond Lab at the Kennedy School that helps states and localities to design and implement social impact bond approaches in social policy. He previously served as a senior official at the White House Office of Management and Budget in the Obama administration. Jeff, it's great to have you with us. Welcome.
Andy, it's great to be with you.
For those new to the social impact bond approach, it can be a bit confusing, especially because there's some sometimes complicated financing arrangements involved. But at its core, how do you describe what the approach is?
The basic idea is that instead of paying for slots in programs and for social service agencies to deliver a specific quantity of service, a pay-for-success contract pays instead based on the impact that the services achieve. So just to give a concrete example, in the very first pay-for-success contract in the world, the Peterborough one in the UK, there's an organization that is delivering services to try to keep people coming out of prison from going back to prison, and they're getting paid not per person served or per hour of work or anything like that. They're getting paid based on whether they can reduce the fraction of people who go back to prison.
So, Jeff, the pay for success or social impact bond approach is relatively new in the U.S., but interest in it has grown very quickly in just a few years. Two states, New York and Massachusetts, are already implementing SIBs, as is New York City, and those projects all focus on reducing prison recidivism. And about a dozen other states and cities are designing SIBs or considering doing so. What's your sense about why the approach has gotten so much attention so quickly from elected leaders and other public officials?
I think it really is the perfect tool for the kind of fiscal times we're in, where if you have a really effective program that has the potential to save money down the road, and you go explain that it exists to a budget director is likely to say, first, well, that's great, but I can't even afford to pay for all the things we're already committed to paying for, so we can't try this new thing, even if it's promising. And second, how do you know for sure it's going to work? Lots of people show up and say, I got this wonderful program that if you invest in it, it'll pay off down the road, but the evidence of it isn't that strong. And what's neat about this social impact bond approach is the government only pays if the thing works. So it's like a money-back guarantee for taxpayers. So what it allows governments to do is really switch their focus from paying for remedial expenses down the road toward paying for the preventative services up front. So I think that's the first thing it's doing. It's changing the conversation away from remediation and toward prevention. Secondly, it's building in rigorous evaluation and measurement of outcomes so that we can actually figure out whether the program works. Today, most social spending we do, we have no idea whether it works or not, and some is probably terrific and some probably is completely ineffective, but we can't really tell. And really, once something gets into the budget, it's basically immortal, regardless of whether it works, because we never measure whether it works. But pay-for-success contracts, if you try a new program, and 3 or 4 years from now it hasn't worked, taxpayers have won doubly, even in an unsuccessful project. First of all, they haven't had to pay for it, and secondly, we won't keep spending money on the thing forever, because we will know it didn't work. So I think that's the second reason people are excited about this tool. But if I were going to actually focus on one aspect of this, I think that the main thing that this tool is allowing governments to do that they can't, or that's very hard to do with conventional tools, is really provide a leadership or management strategy to allow them to do things that are really hard to do with conventional management and procurement techniques. Many of our hardest social problems, to make progress on them, will take several years. And in particular, it'll take a reengineering of the systems through which government matches the high-need individuals to the right services. And it's really hard with existing mechanisms to get everyone to focus on a hard problem, like how do we get the right people to the right services, and stay focused on that for 3 or 4 or 5 years until the problem is improved. It's hard with conventional management techniques because, first of all, the assistant secretary or whoever the policy lead is probably turns over every 18 months. Then on top of that, you have annual budget cycles, so you can't really make a commitment for the long term. And you can have trouble getting different agencies to work together. For example, if one agency has to make an upfront investment that's going to save money in another agency. But just more generally, governments tend to get distracted by the crisis of the day, and keeping sustained attention for 2, 3, 4 years that it takes to actually move the dial on doing better on a social problem can be really difficult. What these pay-for-success contracts do is they tend to be of a 4 to 6 year duration, And they basically lock in the government and its partners from the private sector in a multi-year relationship where they are stuck with each other, and they got and there's an outcome that everyone's focused on. And so it's a mechanism to actually allow these kinds of complicated multi-year data-focused, outcome-focused collaborations to actually happen. And that's just something that's really, really difficult to do with existing tools of government.
I want to ask you, Jeff, about some of the misconceptions that you see in the field about social impact bonds. But first, tell us about where the focus is policy-wise for social impact bonds or pay-for-success approaches so far. I mentioned that reducing recidivism has been an important focus for these early projects. Tell us about that and also about any other policy areas that are on the horizon.
Sure. It's not an accident that the first pay-for-success contracts have been targeting recidivism, because a key element of these projects is they tend to be done in policy areas where if you make upfront investments today, preventative investments, you save money down the road later. And what's nice about recidivism is it tends to be the same level of government that would be purchasing the preventative services, for example, transitional services to help people who are coming out of prison get jobs. It's the same level of government that would be purchasing those services and also getting the savings, because state governments tend to run all the prisons or most of the prisons. So if a state invests in the prevention, they also get the savings. And recidivism is also something where it's pretty clear what we're trying to achieve, which is, you know, reduce crime or reduced returns to prison, and it's something you can measure with existing government data sets. And frankly, the savings come pretty quick within 2 or 3 or 4 years of delivering the service. What we're now seeing is governments testing this tool with, I think, somewhat more complicated and challenging policy areas, but it's looking like it's going to work there as well. For example, a couple of states are looking at early childhood interventions, including prenatal care and services for first-time low-income pregnant women to try to reduce the number of low birth weight births. And that's a more challenging environment to set up a SIB in for a couple reasons. One is that the savings will presumably mostly go through Medicaid, and the state will only capture some of those, because some of the savings will also go to the federal government, which pays part of the cost of Medicaid. And in addition, a lot of the benefits from an early childhood intervention, some of them come immediately in the form of lower NICU costs or lower medical costs in the first couple of years of life. But some of the benefits will show up in lower special ed costs when the kids start school, in lower rates of juvenile delinquency and crime, in higher earnings. And so those kind of things are very much in the long run. And so for a SIB to be set up in that kind of policy area, you tend to have to use short-term indicators as proxies for the long-term ones, because no one's going to sit around and wait 18 years to figure out what actually happened and then get paid back at that point.
And turning to the misconceptions, Jeff, what do you find that people may misunderstand about this approach?
Let me give you two. The first is simply people think that a social impact bond is a bond or a type of government debt, and it isn't. A pay-for-success contract using a social impact bond is simply, from the government perspective, is simply a contract where the government says if certain outcomes or certain impacts are achieved, then it pays, and if they're not, it won't pay. And in that sense, it's not that different from saying, you know, if they're contracting to build a bridge, hey, we're only going to pay when you finish building that bridge. But what is different in this case is there tends to be a several-year lag between when the services are delivered and when we can tell that the impact has occurred. So if you're delivering services to keep people from going back to prison, service providers deliver services for 2 years, then you wait 2 years to measure the outcomes, and then perhaps in year five they get paid based on what they achieved. Well, what service provider do you know that has the balance sheet where it can deliver services for 2 or 3 or 4 years before getting paid? That won't work. And so what happens in these contracts is that private investors provide the operating capital for the service providers, and that's how they're able to deliver services up front and wait and get paid at the end. And in addition, the private investors are absorbing the risk, because they're the ones primarily who don't get paid back if the performance targets aren't hit. And so the key thing here is, from the government perspective, it's just a performance contract, but in the background, on the private sector side, there's this financing arrangement going on where investors are supporting the service provider. And again, that's not really that much different than when the government contracts to build a bridge. Often the construction company is borrowing money from a bank. The government's not really paying any attention to that. The government just cares about getting the bridge built. Largely, this is the same, But what's somewhat different here is the time lag between service delivery and getting paid, and also the risk, because a lot of social services, when we rigorously assess them, they turn out not to work. And so the investors are truly taking a significant risk that they might not get paid back.
And tell us about the other misconception.
I would say the other misconception is a slightly more subtle one, but I think it's worth talking about. Sometimes you hear people say, why use this approach? It's more costly than if we just paid for the services directly. And what they mean by that is that in these contracts, governments pay a rate of return to the investors above and beyond the costs of delivering services if the project turns out to be quite successful. And the reason, of course, they do that is that the investors are taking on risk, and so they have to get paid both for the time value of their money and for the risk they take on. So people have looked at some of these contracts and said, hey, look, if the provider achieves the maximum performance, the government might be paying 30% more than the cost of services to compensate for risk. That means the government's overpaying. But that's not the right way to look at it, because the government pays more under this setup if the provider is successful, but the government doesn't pay at all if the provider is not successful. So if there's a 70% chance that the provider succeeds and a 30% chance that it fails, in 70% of the time, the government might be paying 1.3 times the cost of services, but in the other 30%, it's paying nothing. In expectation, basically the government's paying the same amount on average as if it paid for the services directly.
Related to your last point, Jeff, I know you've emphasized that the approach is more than just offsetting risk or even lowering costs. It's about getting better results, results that you wouldn't have without this approach. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, that's right. It's not just that the government is trying to hand off risk. I think the more important thing going on here is that the government is using a leadership strategy or a management strategy to get everyone to focus on outcomes. And so the hope here is not simply that the government buys something that it could buy otherwise, but that we're actually going to get quite a bit better outcomes than we would if we bought the thing directly, because everyone's going to be focused on the outcome, on really doing fundamental systems changes in the way that government is connecting vulnerable populations and services. For example, in the New York State Criminal Justice Project, they have folks coming out of state prison, and they have a terrific service provider called CEO who has a proven track record that's been demonstrated with a randomized controlled trial of increasing the employment of people coming out of prison. And what the state's trying to do is take basically the 50% of people coming out of prison who are the highest risk of offending and connect them to this program. And so they're targeting the resources toward the highest need individuals, and they're trying hard to have the handoff between the parole department and the service provider be much more focused and less sort of haphazard than in the past, so that they're keeping track of every single person and do they make it to their job training. And it's just a very different approach than the approach that says, hey, we'll pay someone to deliver services. They can go sort of find whoever they want to deliver services to, and we sort of hope if we do that, we'll get enough of the high-need people taken care of.
A final question for you. I don't think there's any doubt that an important catalyst in the social impact bond movement in the United States has been the Harvard Kennedy School Social Impact Bond Technical Assistance Lab, or the SIB Lab as it's called. Tell us about the role and the purpose of the lab.
The role of the SIB Lab is to provide pro bono assistance to state and local governments that are exploring this concept. What we do is we put a full-time government innovation fellow on the ground, typically in the governor or mayor's policy office or in the state or city budget office. And that person helps coordinate the development of the pay-for-success contract in that jurisdiction and also draws upon our team in Cambridge for additional technical assistance around complex topics such as how to write a good incentive contract or how to set up a good rigorous evaluation to figure out the impact that the payments are going to be made upon.
I'll put a link to the SIB Lab on the blog. Jeff, congratulations to you and all of the people involved in the SIB Lab for a lot of terrific progress on this topic. And thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.